content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. For our first article today, Stingrays Are a Bigger Threat Than Sharks, by Catherine Gammon. Stingray 12 is surprisingly calm for an animal that's getting squeegeed. The ray, roughly the size of a dinner plate, is submerged in the sand of a tank, about the size of a chest freezer. Even the golden eyes on top of her head are buried in the sentiment. She stays motionless as the researcher Ben Perlman of California State University at Long Beach, CSULB, carefully pushes the sand from her mottled brown body and the squeegee, offering the scientists a little protection from the hazardous-looking barbs poking out halfway down Stingray 12's tail. "Sorry to bother you," Perlman murmurs. Six undergraduate students peer over his shoulder, and one, Carly Brenner, steps forward holding a 3D-printed silicone human foot glued to a PCV pipe. A little closer," Perlman coaches, as Brenner brings the foot centimeters from the stingray's body. "Go for it," he says, and Brenner takes aim at the stingray's left pectoral fin, stamping down with a flexible foot. The ray doesn't move at all. "No response," Perlman says. "The result will be logged into his lab's study of what makes stingrays attack, science that Perlman hopes will eventually help people avoid painful stings from the serrated barbs, each about the length of an adult human's big toe." Perlman's lab in Long Beach, California, aptly named STAB, for Stingray and Butterfly Biomechanics Lab, the Butterfly Project is currently paused, explores how and why stingrays move and behave the way they do. Seal Beach, one of the area's popular surf spots, about 3 miles from the lab, is colloquially known as Ray Bay. Stingrays love to congregate there in the calm, warm waters at the mouth of the San Gabriel River, and lifeguards document upwards of 500 painful stabs, injuries from the rays each year. Studying the rays' behavior and their stinging process can open a new window into human interactions with what the lab calls danger pancakes, Perlman says. His research focuses on round rays, the most abundant ray species inhabiting California's waters. Their behavior also makes them the most dangerous to the unsuspecting passerby. Though other rays quickly flee at the hint of danger, round rays stay buried in the sand and even hold their breath as a predator, such as a juvenile great white shark, or a perceived predator such as a human goes by, relying on their mottled color for camouflage. It's this protective behavior that makes them far more likely to get stepped on and explains why the majority of stingray injuries in California are attributed to round rays, rather than the bat rays or diamond stingrays that also live in the area. Stingray barbs are a kind of dermal denticle, like a tooth, on the tail that can be whipped around. In a strike, the animal releases a toxin from glandular cells at the base of one of the barbs. The toxin travels along a mucus coating and gets envenomated or injected into the recipient through a puncture wound. Some ray species have barbs with serrated notches, which can make the barb stick into the skin of their attacker. Chris Lowe, a shark biologist who leads CSULB's shark lab, estimates that about 10,000 people a year are injured by stingrays in Southern California. Round rays are like burger patties for juvenile white sharks, which is one of the reasons Lowe and his fellow shark scientists are keenly interested in stingray distributions and populations. The shark lab, established in the 1960s, has studied stingrays for years, but never their stinging mechanics. Perlman, meanwhile, didn't set out to research rays. He's a fish biomechanist who studied how surf perch swim in kelp forests and how amphibious fishes in the tropics use their muscles to haul themselves out of the water. He also studied how birds' wings can shapeshift during flight and how bullfrogs load up their tendons to increase their jumping power. In 2018, he took a job with CSULB as a teaching professor and left research for a few years. Then he got a knock on his door in the fall of 2021. Lowe had a question. He wanted to know if Perlman could help test a new material for surf booties developed by an inventor whose kids were afraid of rays and a collaborator with expertise in materials science. Would the booties protect against stingray strikes as designed? After receiving funds from an anonymous surf-loving donor, Perlman hired a student, and together they collected rays from Seal Beach to serve as their test subjects. To figure out if the material could protect against strikes, Perlman first had to understand the dynamics of the stingray's defense behavior. His initial research goal was to capture strikes on camera and use the footage to measure velocity and acceleration, which he could then use to calculate force. He bought a disembodied foot from a store, Spirit Halloween, filled it with sand, and epoxied it to a piece of plastic pipe to mimic a human foot for the trials. That was a great jumping-off point, Perlman says. To learn more about what makes the rays decide to strike, he designed an experiment that divides the ray's body into four different regions: mid-body, left pectoral fin, right pectoral fin, and snout. His team uses the zombie foot, which was upgraded to a 3D printed silicon foot in 2023 because it's more realistic, to step on the different parts of the body and record the animal's reaction. Initial findings are stark. Rays only strike if someone steps on their mid-body, where all their organs are located. That makes them strike 85% of the time. Stepping on their sides just makes them swim away. A bop on the snout doesn't elicit an attack either. The findings are consistent, regardless of the ray's size, age, or sex. The lab has also been doing studies of the new material Loeb brought to Perlman, neoprene with a rubber composite lining, to see if it can stand up to the forces of a stingray strike. The researchers clip off barbs, akin to cutting off a fingernail, because the keratin-based barbs regrow within a few months, and use a machine to force them into the material with increasing pressure. So far, they have found the material to resist the force of most stingrays. In addition to their barbs, some stingrays have large, thorny, scale-like denticles that provide passive protection, says Chris Martinez, a fish biologist at UC Irvine, who studies stingray morphology. The thorns can pierce skin and make a predator's life unpleasant, he says, but the stinger is something extra, a targeted weapon the animal can actively control to inflict damage. The ultimate hope, Perlman says, is that the research will translate into best practices for people at the beach. For decades, surfers in Southern California have used a technique called the stingray shuffle, where they take tiny steps along the ground instead of big steps to warn stingrays who might be buried in the sand. Perlman says his experiments have scientifically backed up the stingray shuffle. When someone takes tiny steps, they are not going to come into contact with the mid-body section of a ray, so they won't be struck. Vibrations through the sand can also give the animal a chance to move to safety. The rays are just going to escape or not respond, Perlman says. He knows what's at stake. Last summer, he was holding down a ray's tail with a net while using a scalpel to make a small identifying notch on the animal's body, which has to be redone every few months as the notches grow out, when his hand slipped and the fish's tail whipped around and struck an artery on his wrist. Blood immediately squirted everywhere, and the pain was a 7.5 out of 10. He used the only known treatment, which was to submerge his hand in hot water to denature the poison. It took nearly 2 hours for the pain to fade. His wrist still bears a scar. The lab is now engaged in a flurry of research activity that could keep Perlman and his teammates busy for the rest of the decade. They are testing how the size of a foot affects the likelihood of a stingray strike, to see if someone who is lighter and smaller is less likely to get stung than someone larger. The researchers are also in the midst of studying rays as they bury themselves in the sand to understand why and how the animals move sand particles around. Eventually, the lab will also use 3D imaging from micro-CT scans to look at the curvature, sharpness, and angle of serrations across different round ray barbs. That will help them understand the variation within the species and even within an individual. Sometimes after being clipped, a barb will grow back in a different shape or size. Sharks tend to loom larger than rays in Californian consciousness, Martinez says. Rays don't get as much attention because they're not as big. They don't have the big teeth like some large sharks do. But you're more likely to be harmed by one of those than a big shark. The stats prove his point. In 2022, 57 unprovoked shark attacks occurred around the globe, and stingray injuries were likely in the thousands. After her encounter with the silicon foot, Stingray 12 gets a 10-minute break before her other pectoral fin is stepped on. Perlman watches as she buries herself back in the sand. It feels good to take a figurative step toward helping fellow Californians avoid stabs and stings, he said. Ultimately, if surfers and swimmers can use his research to avoid danger pancakes, everyone's time at the beach, rays included, will be more harmonious. Our second article is a book review. Don't give up on tourism, just do it better. Paige McClanahan's book, The New Tourist, argues for recognizing how potent travelers' social force is. This article was written by Chelsea Liu. In 1956, the poet Elizabeth Bishop worried about the imprudence and absurdity of going abroad. Should we have stayed at home and thought of here? She writes in her poem, Questions of Travel. Is it right to be watching strangers in a play, in this strangest of theaters? What childishness is it that there's a breath of life in our bodies? We are determined to rush to see the sun the other way around. Decades later, the phrasing of these questions and the fretful frame of mind behind them seem to perfectly sum up a new attitude toward international travel, one of moral unease. Every summer, a litany of headlines appears about tourists behaving badly, people carving their names into the Colosseum or posing naked in sacred sites, for example. Even the ordinary business of tourism leaves much to be desired. The crowds at the Louvre make seeing the Mona Lisa such a brief and unsatisfying experience. Foot traffic, noise, and trash slowly degrade sites famous for their natural beauty or historical significance. In the Canary Islands, the Greek island of Paros, and Oaxaca, Mexico, residents of popular destinations have protested against throngs of visitors. For many years, it seems somehow wrong now to plunge blithely into another country's culture and landscapes, subjecting locals to one's presence for the sake of leisure. While the long-haul flights that make these trips possible emit massive amounts of greenhouse gases, Bishop's queries are our own. Would we be doing the world a favor if we didn't sally forth so confidently to other countries and just stayed home? Amid this quagmire, the journalist Paige McClanahan's book, The New Tourist, is a level-headed defense of tourism that proposes a genuinely helpful framework for thinking about our own voyages. We tourists, a label that includes everyone who travels abroad for work or fun, think about the practice's pleasures all wrong, she says, and discount its potential. Many of us are used to thinking of ourselves as simple hedonists when we go on vacation, or perhaps as economic participants of the tourism industry. But we've largely forgotten about the power we hold as contributors, however unwitting, to a vast and potent social force, McClanahan writes. The New Tourist is dedicated to fleshing out this bird's-eye view of tourism as a formidable phenomenon, one that we participate in every time we leave our home country, and one we ignore at our peril. Traveling the world was once reserved for the very rich. Now, thanks to a series of recent developments, including deregulation of the airline industry in 1978 and the launch of Travelocity and Expedia in the 90s, planning a trip to Iceland or even Antarctica is easier than ever. The world saw more than 1 billion international tourist arrivals last year, and tourism contributed nearly 10% to global GDP. This monumental traffic now shapes the world for both good and ill, as McClanahan demonstrates. Tourism revitalized the city of Liverpool and employs nearly a quarter of the workforce of the Indian state of Kerala. It's also turning places such as Barcelona's city center and Amsterdam's red light district into miserable, kitschy tourist traps and pricing out local residents. Tourism also has the capacity to shape how travelers imagine other countries. McClanahan dedicates an entire chapter to soft power, a government's political ability to influence other states, because, as she points out, our travels change where we're likely to spend our money and which places we're inclined to regard with empathy. Tourism has elevated Iceland, for instance, from a country that North Americans knew little about to a recognized player on the world stage. And Saudi Arabia plans to pour hundreds of billions of dollars into its tourism industry with a goal of attracting a planned 150 million visitors a year by 2030. For a nation, especially one striving to change its international reputation, the benefits of tourism aren't merely financial. The minute you put your feet on the ground, an expert on nation branding tells McClanahan, your perception starts changing for the better in 90% of cases. In fact, McClanahan took a trip to Saudi Arabia as research for this book. I was scared to go, she writes, given what she'd read about the country's treatment of both women and journalists, more scared than I've been ahead of any trip in recent memory. But she was captivated by her conversations with Fatima, a tour guide who drives the two of them around in her silver pickup truck. Over the course of the day, they discussed the rights of Saudi women and the assassination of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Her answers were thoughtful, many surprised me, and I find myself disagreeing with several outright, McClanahan writes. When McClanahan returned home and published an interview with Fatima for the New York Times, however, outraged readers excoriated her. Just curious, how much did MBS pay you to tourism wash his country? One wrote in her email, referring to the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. McClanahan likens these commenters to acquaintances who tell her they refuse to visit the U.S. because they're disgusted by some aspect of our country. Traveling to Saudi Arabia didn't change her awareness of the country's repression, but it did give her a glimpse of the breadth and depth of my ignorance of the place, and a recognition that the country has to be viewed with nuance. In addition to its regressive policies, she writes, the trip made her acknowledge the complexity of a land that millions of people call home. McClanahan's anecdote gestures at what we might gain from tourism, which, she argues, has now become humanity's most important means of conversation across cultures. What physically traveling to another country grants you is a sense of how ordinary things are in most parts of the world. Unless you're limiting yourself to the most touristy spots, going someplace else plunges you briefly into the daily fabric of existence, where you must navigate convenience stores and train schedules and local currency, surrounded by other people just trying to live their lives. Traveling, McClanahan suggests, helps people more keenly discern the difference between a state's positions and the culture of its people by seeing it with their own eyes. This firsthand exposure is a much better reflection of the truth than flattened extreme images provided by the internet and by the news. That's a good thing, because by sheer numbers, this kind of cross-cultural contact happens on a much larger scale than any other. Seeing the world more clearly seems beneficial to everyone involved. To encourage this global citizen frame of mind, governments, businesses, and tourists alike have to change the way the travel industry works. If we are to consider tourism from a collective phenomenon, then most of the burden to improve it shouldn't fall on individuals. Tourism is an area in which too many governments only get the memo that they should pay attention after too much damage has been done, McClanahan writes. But the social lens also suggests that there are better and worse ways to be a tourist. Traveling will always be personal, but we shift our behavior to acknowledge our role in a broader system. We also improve our chances of having a meaningful experience. The old tourist essentially is a boorish figure from the headlines, oriented towards self, someone who superimposes their fantasies onto a place and then is outraged when their expectations aren't met. What sets apart the new tourist is a focus on the place they're visiting. Don't make it about you, in short. Make it about where you are. Traveling well, then, involves basic acts of physical courtesy. Don't litter. Don't cross barriers intended to protect wildlife. Don't take fragments of beaches or ruins. And generally, don't be a nuisance. But it also involves some amount of research and critical thinking about the destination itself. I've taken to using my international trips as crash courses in the history of a particular country, which mostly means reading books and spending large amounts of time at museums and historical sites. But this is just what I also happen to enjoy. The point is to invest something of yourself to try to engage with a different place, an effort that strikes me as more honest accounting of the undeniable costs of going abroad. Even Bishop concludes in Questions of Travel that the endeavor is ultimately worthwhile. Surely, she writes, it would have been a pity not to have seen the trees along this road, really exaggerated in their beauty, not to have seen them gesturing like noble pantomimists robed in pink. Next, a science article, Beech Trees Are Masters of Coordination, by Megan Wilcoxon. Each summer, like clockwork, millions of beech trees throughout Europe sync up, tuning the reproductive physiology to one another. Within a matter of days, trees produce all the seeds they'll make for a year, then release their fruit onto the forest floor to create a new generation and feed the surrounding ecosystem. It's a reproductive spectacle, known as masting, that's common to many tree species, but European beeches are unique in their ability to synchronize this behavior on a continental scale. From England to Sweden to Italy, across multiple time zones and climates, somehow these trees know when to reproduce. But how? A group of ecologists has now identified the distinctive cue, what they call the celestial starting gun, that, along with balmy weather, triggers the phenomenon. Their analysis of more than 60 years' worth of seeding data suggests that European beech trees time their masting to the summer solstice and peak daylight. Ecologists have floated various theories to explain the mysteries of masting. One idea is that for wind-pollinated plants like beech trees, synchronized flower production improves pollinization efficiency. The high, spreading blooms of pollen created during masting produce more offspring. It may also be beneficial because masting trees go through periods of boom and bust, with high masting fruitful summers followed by low masting barren ones. It's easy to see why masting trees synchronize their seed pollinization production. Understanding how they do it, however, is more complicated. Plants usually synchronize their reproduction by timing it to the same weather signals, and warming temperatures and heavy rainfall correlate well with coordinated masting, suggesting that trees synchronize to weather cues. But 3 years ago, the ecologist Mikhail Bogdanovich and his team at Adam Mickiewicz University in Poznan, Poland, found that European beeches coordinate their reproduction across some 900 miles, virtually the largest synchronization response of any tree species in Europe. By their calculations, the synchronization area is larger than that of the Norway spruce, which massed over only about 600 miles and are less tightly coordinated in time. The length of the synchronization among the beaches seems to challenge the standard explanation. If weather alone prompted masting, a stint of rainy days in England and a stretch of extreme heat in Italy should knock the masting out of sync. Yet European beaches reliably mast together, despite huge differences in regional weather. The idea that masting could be linked to the summer solstice was so stimulating that Valentin Journet, an ecologist and postdoc in Bodvigovich's laboratory, went home later that day to dig into the data. Within hours, Journet had organized a massive beach data set analyzing daily seed production dating back to 1952. He coordinated the data with temperature and found that precise uptick in masting just after the June solstice and lasting through mid-July. Journet's analysis suggested that European beech trees do mast in response to summer temperatures, but the twist is that they do not drop their seeds until they have sensed the longest day of the year. That combination of signals organizes the masting of a wide-flung beech trees into a compact period. Bogzevich's team took a novel approach by analyzing the daily data. It's rare for ecologists to track behavior at such a granular level, Vicaria says. By recording incremental changes to response to daylight, the team showed the trees react to subtle external cues within an unexpectedly narrow window. It's not surprising their intimate biological clock synchronize their innate biological clocks with changes in light. Most organisms do in some way. The European beech is also not the first organism that was identified as keeping track of day length and the solstices. For example, long-distance migratory songbirds set their internal clocks to the photoperiod and use the summer solstice to time their nesting and migration. Many corals use day length to initiate spawning, but they prefer to reproduce under cover of darkness when the days are the shortest. If the solstice is shown to activate a genetic mechanism, it would be a major breakthrough for the field. Currently, there's little data to explain how trees behave as they do. No one even knows whether trees naturally grow old and die, Vicario says. Ecologists struggle just to study trees. From branches to root systems, the parts of a tree say very little about the physiology of the tree as a whole. What experts do know is that discovering how trees sense their environment will help them answer questions that have been stumping them for decades. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.